Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The coronavirus case load and death toll continue to mount at home and abroad, with more than 200,000 Americans dead since the start of the pandemic. The Federal Aviation Administration is nearing certification of the design and software changes required to Boeing's 737 MAX jetliner so that it can get back in the air. The plane was grounded, has been grounded for more than a year in the wake of two accidents that killed almost 350 people. The International Air Transport Association trade body has issued its latest travel projections as more carriers announce pre-boarding COVID tests to instill passenger confidence. What do these trends mean for aircraft makers, especially for wide-body traffic and production rates? Britain's defense review continues, and officials are increasingly discussing the need for major trade-offs. All this as Russia steps up its cyber attacks on UK military targets. The Pentagon's floating an idea of a 500-ship Navy, a notion that most of Washington's savviest analysts say is meaningless. Switzerland held a vote for new fighters, and Hensoldt and Rolls-Royce equity offerings are underway, and we get an update. Joining us now to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy right up the street from me in sunny Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Good to be here, as always, Vago.
Great to be here, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Ron, start us off and let's quickly go around the horn. U.S.-China trade tensions continue on the rise. Obviously, Washington targeting Huawei, ZTE, TikTok, to a degree, WeChat, and now the largest China's largest chipmaker, Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp, or SMIC. This comes at the time at a time when the United States government and Boeing want or will want China to certify the 737 MAX as well, which is a very big customer for the airplane. Talk to us about how the street is looking at all of these trade tensions and some news reports that even if Joe Biden were to win, that on the toughness toward China, not all that much may change. So where do we kind of find ourselves? And each one of you can go in any direction you guys want. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I would, just to frame it, I would say, you know, pre-pandemic for sure, that, you know, I think the street view on a tougher stance with technology. So this transition, if you will, from a trade war of sorts to a tech war of sorts, didn't have that much traction, but it definitely does today. You've seen the heat turned up there on, you know, on the government level, government to government level, right? And I think the street is starting to get that now. I think there were a lot of folks, particularly in the tech space, who didn't believe that you'd start to see rhetoric, and in some cases, not just rhetoric, at these levels, you know, in those markets. So the street is digesting that, right? And I think that's one of the things that could be adding to some volatility in the market, particularly in the tech space. Although, to be clear, I'm not a strategist or whatever. I'm just the aerospace guy. But so we're seeing that for sure. And it, you know, this is interesting because this is coming at a time, and I'll just mention this quickly because I know Richard and Sasha will have stuff to add on this, when the 737 MAX is, you know, starting to get a little momentum. You know, it looks like you could get a certification from the FAA in the coming weeks or month or something like that. Europe doesn't look like it's too far behind. And then really the next big question is China. And when you look at the backlog of the MAX, it's about a third Chinese, right? So China for the MAX is an important variable. So why don't I leave it there and then hand it off to my partners on the call.
And I just want to point out, right, FAA Administrator Steve Dixon has said, I think that this coming week, he wants to fly on the airplane to get a sense on where they are on the program. And obviously, unfortunately, there's a shareholder suit that's been announced as well, which we can talk about in a moment. Sash, what's your sense? And then Richard, let's get your take as well.
you know, there's clearly some momentum in the certification process. We're still quite surprised at the degree to which the NTSB's recommendations, especially with regard to, you know, the level or the number and simultaneous action of alarms in the cockpit, and indeed, you know, more generally, the, you know, lack of redundancies of sensors has not been fully taken on board, certainly by the FAA. I think it'll be quite interesting to see. I suspect the Europeans may not do that, but the most interesting story, I think, this week was actually the headline in globaltimes.cn, which is the Chinese official news agency, English language service. And, you know, that was headlined, Boeing needs to do more to get over the 737 MAX malaise. And it's a very, very subtly written article because it focuses on safety and it focuses on the degree to which Boeing lacks public trust in the Chinese market. Well, you know, that's got to be true, hasn't it? But underneath it all, this is an article which is sending a signal. And it says, China will be very cautious in making the safety approval decision. And the process may be a little bit longer given the impact on market confidence. What I find fascinating about this is the Chinese saying, it's up to us to decide how and when to recertify the MAX. It's nothing to do with the FAA. And of course, at the moment, this is a risk-free, cost-free process for China. If the MAX had been grounded, or when the MAX was first grounded, pre-COVID, Chinese airlines were screaming for capacity because they were growing in high single digits every year. Now, they don't need any capacity. So they can decide to take their time and play the MAX recertification for political reasons with no cost to their airlines. And I think that it's the asymmetry of cost versus impact at the moment is very strongly favors the Chinese and really does hurt Boeing in this regard. And I think this was a, you know, pretty important shot across Boeing and the US's bows that was being fired this week.
Richard?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Not to read too much into it from a cultural perspective, but in terms of warfare, in terms of any kind of conflict, the Chinese have always been good at, just what Sash said, sending signals. And the West doesn't necessarily see things, you know, we have more of a Clausewitzian view of things where, you know, force is applied, things are negotiated, wars are either on or off. And the whole concept of getting...
You're basically saying that we're not nearly as subtle about reading between lines as
That's
we
right.
should be when dealing with somebody as savvy as China in trying to telegraph its messages between those lines.
That's
well, he didn't
exactly
hit me in the head.
Saying.
He must like me.
That's precisely right, what I'm saying. I think you're either friends or enemies, whereas they're more subtle. And, you know, the analogy that's often used is that the West's favorite game is chess, which is winner, loser, fighting, not fighting, whereas their game is Go. You know, if you've ever played Go, of course, it's really hard to discern winners and losers. There are feints, there are moves. Eventually, someone kind of wins, but the road there is one of, you know, is a very long road there. So I think we've got to be super careful with this sort of thing, because if we tend to go too far and we tend to say, all right, it's either decoupling or we're together as one big world economy. That's it. And they start doing what I think they're doing, which is a kind of soft decoupling until we get the message, then it runs the risk of being worse than it needs to be.
I just want to talk very, very briefly about whether or not, and maybe one of you can take this before we go to the IATA numbers.
I can jump in.
You know, Ron, take it, right? I mean, is the shareholder suit something major to worry about? Is it like we find some of these shareholder suits that have no teeth, or is this something that could potentially be something that does hit the company? Because they're alleging, right, poor management, poor safety culture. And in the wake of that devastating House Transportation Committee report, you know, there's a lot of fodder there for somebody who wants to sue the company.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the board, which is something we have, and we've brought up here in the past on the podcast, and you compare the Boeing board to the Airbus board and the number of engineers on, you know, one board versus the other. Boeing had far fewer engineers. The board seemed more focused on financial issues, political issues, the navigating the hill, as opposed to kind of just kind of, you know, being a hardcore airplane company. That said, they have, you know, changed the board. I mean, the board has been actively evolving since the beginning of this crisis. They've developed a safety committee, so on and so forth. So by their own admission, if you will, I think they recognize that there was a weakness on the board. You can argue, have they fixed that? Probably not. Is it better than it was? Sure, right? But I think what was brought up in the congressional hearing and then what's brought up in the lawsuit is stuff we all kind of know and we've all talked about. So it's important from that point of view. You know, is it going to have teeth on the stock price? And probably not, but it's just one more thing, right? I mean, it's just right. Like, you know, with the 787 stuff that came out a couple of weeks ago, in and of itself, was it a big deal? Probably not. But in light of everything else, it's just one more thing.
Sash, lead us off on the analysis of the latest IATA numbers and what they mean for wide body travel and what it ultimately means for production rates or narrow body production rates as well, right? I mean, either way, what does it mean for production rates writ large?
Yeah, I mean, look, frankly, the numbers that we're getting out of IATA at the moment are showing domestic recovery in China nearly complete, but no recovery whatsoever in international travel, and that's the same sort of theme. I mean, you know, the TSA numbers have stabilized at about 70% down. There's a lot of noise in those numbers at the moment, but the majority of that is U.S. domestic. Almost all of the stats associated. The worst domestic or, you know, regional numbers are actually Europe. Europe is doing really badly. Europe has started to go backwards again. But all of the international stuff is weak. And that is why, you know, wide bodies look horribly vulnerable. You know, there is no demand from any airline for new wide-bodied aircraft at the moment, except, you know, possibly for a freighter or two. But I don't think that's enough to keep some of these lines going. I'm not of you. You know, when we look at what some of the major airlines are talking about, Delta was talking about rescheduling 40 of its aircraft deliveries from Airbus. Now, the headline said this year. I don't think they've got 40 aircraft left for delivery this year. But, you know, if Delta wants to reschedule 40 aircraft from near-term deliveries, let's say the next 12 months or so, those are A220s, A320s, A320neos, 330s, 350s. I mean, it really has got the full suit there. But this is the sort of thing that becomes the tipping point for production cuts. Wide bodies, there is just clearly no demand. But even narrow bodies, there really isn't demand for aircraft anymore. And so we don't take a huge amount of comfort from any of the stats coming out from IATA and indeed any of the other generators of this sort of data.
Richard?
Yeah, I don't think it's any surprise. I mean, we're heading into the valley that I think we saw back in March. I think all of us saw it back in March, you know, when this all started, that international would be down the longest. Having said that, until we get much better testing, much better contact tracing, much better, and ideally a vaccine, much better everything, we're not going to see any kind of comeback in international traffic. We're not. Abandon all hope until, I don't know, June, maybe. I'll regard it as a major strategic win for those of us in the aviation business that if there is a Paris Air Show and we are at it, that would be fantastic. Otherwise... Yeah, well, we'll see, right? And otherwise, it's, you know, sometime next summer. And until then, we're just going into a really nasty valley. We already had an existing overcapacity situation with twin-aisle jets. You can see that in the availability numbers, the retirement numbers, the lease rates and asset value numbers. And then on top of that, you had the secular shift away from twin-aisles and towards single-aisles anyway, especially as the 321neo comes online. So... are production numbers going to get worse for twin aisles? Yes. Are they going to stay really bad for a lot longer? Yes. We're still bullish on single aisles, but twin aisles, that is the market bust of the century, really.
And so impact on production rates, Ron, and then I want to get your guys, what you think, if you guys can quantify an impact on production rates.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have to look at IATA's economics group had their chart of the week this week, and it was a particularly illuminating one. And what IATA did was compared forward bookings for each month of the quarter, comparing the third quarter to the fourth quarter. And if you look at, you know, month one, month two, month three of the fourth quarter, they're meaningfully lower than they were month one, month two, month three of the fourth quarter are meaningfully lower than for the third quarter. So, you know, when you look in, you know, the December bookings and you compare those to the September, you know, the third month of the previous quarter, forward bookings are down almost 78%. In month two, they're down 81%. In month one, they're down 76%. So point is, we discussed it, we're going into winter. Winter's coming, but it's really coming, right? I mean, like, you know, the forward booking rates for the fourth quarter for the airlines really, really look awful.
Sash and Richard, how do you do? Can you guys quantify the impact at this point?
Well, I can tell you what our forecasts are because they're, I mean, I'll give you our forecasts for Airbus. And they're much lower than Airbus's current production rate. So, you know, for 2021, we've got production rate of three A350s a month. That compares with Airbus currently producing somewhere between five and six. We've got total production of the A330 of two a month, and that's frankly lucky. And we've got the that's another one off. And then we've got A320 production. You know, COs, NEOs, and so forth, in total running at about 25 a month, and they're currently at 40 a month. That's the sort of scale of the cuts that we expect to come through in the next couple of, next couple of quarters or so, because the demand doesn't support the higher rates.
You know, from my perspective, the most interesting aspect is the 330 NEO. His Sash's figure of two per month being lucky. Yeah, that's right. And I'm not so sure it's supportable. And I think at some point Airbus has to make the decision to whether or not to keep the 330 NEO going because
the way I see it, Richard, I don't see the difference between 330 NEO and CO. You know, it's an A330. It uses a particular assembly line. And I think this is a bit like Boeing 767. It's going to be supported by military versions, which can probably support half an aircraft a month at the moment. And then, you know, frankly, odds and sods. But I think it's false to think of the 330 NEO as being a separate program from the CEO. It's really when you get to bolting the engines on and the pylons that these things start to differ.
Well, also, I'd point out the MRTT isn't necessarily baselined with the 330 NEO yet. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that presents weight and balance issues as it would for any tanker, right? So you've got this question of, did they just kill the NEO, keep the CEO going for the KC-30 model MRTT, and transfer the 330 NEO backlog to the 350 and bolster that and get that, because our numbers aren't too different. And that way you can get to at least a sustainable, you know, five or so per month rate for the 350. In a lot of ways, it's Delta's question because they're the one important 330 NEO customer. Are you the only important 330 NEO customer? They also have the 350. And if they're told, look, maybe one of the reasons you were doing this was for a Delta Tech Ops MRO strategy based upon the Trent 7000 motor, why don't we just admit that that's not going to work out so great for either of us? So with Rolls-Royce acquiescing, let's kill that plane, which is really a pity. I thought it was kind of a good idea, but given the necessities of the twin aisle market, it might be a necessary kill.
Ron, what's your take on all of that?
So, I mean, for sure, a couple of things. From a Boeing point of view, I think Boeing had hoped to deliver most of their inventory of 450 airplanes in a year, right? Clearly, that's not going to happen, right? I mean, you have those 450 airplanes plus the 380 that were grounded, all that capacity hitting a market that really, really doesn't need it. In our forecast, we have those airplanes being delivered out over a little over a 2-year period, and that's probably optimistic, to be frank. On 787, we've got 787 production rates coming down to 5 per month, which at this point is one below where Boeing is at. So we're thinking it'll come down at least one per month more, and it might even come down by two a month to four. Most of the industry participants and suppliers that we talk to are expecting yet another cut in 787s. So we'll see. When 7-3 production starts, it's really going to start slow, right? I mean, that's just a given. So that's, you know, that's the broad impact for Boeing.
Ron, can you talk to us really, really quickly about aid for the industry? American Airlines CEO Doug Parker last week said that he expects $25 billion in federal aid by October 1. Others are less confident that's going to work out. Obviously, each of these air carriers has said we're going to start laying off a lot of people absent more aid. How confident is the street and you that something is actually going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the street view is that something will happen. Therefore, if something doesn't happen, I would expect to see that reflected in the market, which at this point it is not. To be clear,
No, I know it's very simple, but it bears repeating, right? Everybody thinks it's going to happen, which means if it doesn't happen, it's going to be somewhat not positive.
exactly, dead on, right. My gut sense, I mean, this is a lousy answer, but it's the truth. It could happen. I don't know. I mean, it's not, given all the political machinations going on right now, it's not a foregone conclusion that it will happen, but we're still within the realm of possibility, and it is Washington, and they like to run things right up to the last second. So, you know, do we get something at, you know, 11:59 p.m. The night before? We could. We'll see. You know, all hope isn't gone.
And the Speaker of the House, I should note, right? I mean, to your point, is reaching out to the Secretary of the Treasury, and they're sort of trying to work toward a deal between the House and the White House, right? I mean, so there's reason to be a little bit optimistic in this process.
Yeah, right. So that's what we're watching.
Let's move on. Absent any other observations from folks, SASH UK Defense Review is ongoing, and keeping. And playing, to villainous type, Moscow has increased cyber attacks on the UK Ministry of Defense, right? So if there was any chance that London was going to, you know, tone down the threat from Russia, that's certainly not going to be happening. We've been talking about this the last couple of weeks. Some senior officials have been quoted. I saw Will Jessett, one of the senior most civilians in the defense organization, discussed the review a little bit. We're going to have Ed Ferguson, the minister, at the British Embassy, who's going to be on the COMDEF conference, and I'm going to be moderating that panel discussion on the future of defense spending. And we're honored to have Ed on the panel as well. Any sort of greater indication on where we are, given that, you know, continuously it's like, well, we should get rid of tanks, we should get rid of Wedgetail. That was the big debate a couple of weeks ago. There was some discussion of the aircraft carrier, right? Where do we find ourselves in terms of the state of play? And what the meaning of these Russian cyber attacks are?
This is probably rather cynical, but I mean, the question is it the meaning of the Russian cyber attacks or the meaning of the fact that the Ministry of Defense has decided to brief on them? I actually think it's the latter. I think the fact that there was a briefing of journalists by the head of the UK Strategic Command, General Sir Patrick Sanders, and that this gave a quite a deep insight into how the British military are experiencing cyber attacks, but also how they see the whole process and what they are trying to do at a more military level to address this. That sort of briefing doesn't come out of the air. I think this is part of the process of preparing people for a greater weight of the defense budget to be spent on cyber methods and cyber threats relative to, you know, heavy metal, whether it's tanks or, right, you know, warships or submarines or even slightly lighter metal, and which is combat aircraft and helicopters. I think, you know, this briefing did not come by accident. I think the fact that the Russians are reportedly spending a lot of time attacking the UK. I wonder whether that's any that much different to France or Germany. Right. I don't think we really know. It would be nice to think that's because the Russians think Britain is a sort of a major threat. I don't think we should kid ourselves that that's necessarily the case at this stage. But the UK is a large nation in Europe, which is still broadly, you know, a democracy opposed to Russia, you would expect, I think, or a rational person would expect the Russians to be diverting at least some of their very considerable cyber capabilities to testing British capabilities. One of the things I was most interested by, though, that came out of this briefing was a comment that the current British tactical communication system, Bowman, is probably no longer secure. Now, Bowman uses the General Dynamics US SINGARS waveform. It's been in service for 20 years. I've used it. It's horrible. It's the most user-unfriendly interface I have ever come across in military computing. But, you know, we had to accept that because it was supposedly very, very secure. I think it's fascinating that it's now considered not to be secure. I suspect that that is a commentary on Russian tactical communications intercept and jamming capabilities. But, you know, again, that suggests there's going to have to be some significant recapitalization in that direction as well.
I think that that's an incredible verdict coming from someone like you who's actually experienced Klansmen and a bunch of other systems. We won't go there in terms of that conversation. I want to move on and ask you, but I do think what's interesting is that this defense review is also going to be interesting for the amount of effort being put into Britain's Asia role, which I think is going to make it very, very interesting review indeed, because at a strategic level, it does look like senior decision makers are wrapping their minds around what a British role in Asia, an increased British role in Asia, is going to mean. And that's very, very welcome for everybody who wants to figure out ways to increase pressure on China. And I think these deliberations also are ongoing in Paris and in Berlin and elsewhere. Let's keep moving. Switzerland, one of the most democratically minded nations in the world, puts major purchases to the population. The Swiss public voted on immigration, one other thing, but the most important for us was the fighter program, which exceptionally narrowly passed, which would start the conversation very quickly. Sash, give us your take because you're sitting closer. And then Richard, I want your take about how you think this competition will play. Obviously, Switzerland had picked the Gripen, or rather, I should say the new generation Gripen. The folks from Dassault worked really hard. The folks from Eurofighter worked really hard to undo that competition. Obviously, there were some U.S. fingers in there as well. And now we've got a reconstituted competition. Walk us through what this means and what time scale, right? What happens next?
Look, first of all, referendum. I'm frankly astonished that the Swiss electorate decided to approve the fighter purchase precisely because, as you say, they nixed the Gripen order 7-8 years ago now. The Gripen purchase, you could argue Gripen was designed for Switzerland as an export customer. And yet the Swiss then were fed this fantastic story about how, you know, Gripen was incapable of turning, inside the Swiss airspace because it had such a wide turning circle. It was totally unsuitable and so forth. All of those arguments were sort of revisited, and it's a lot of misleading stuff goes on in Swiss referenda. But seems to have passed, and really, you know, we're down to, I think, F-18 versus Rafale. If you look at the Twitter feed of the French Ministry of Defense, the Swiss federal government over the period of coronavirus and the degree to which France was incredibly supportive of Swiss medical systems and to some extent vice versa, relationships between France and Switzerland are about as good as they have been in 15, 20 years at the moment. Me, I'd say it's Rafale to lose.
Richard?
Yeah, pretty good chance of that. And of course, the French probably helped themselves a bit by procuring a bunch of PC-21 Pilatus trainers not too long ago. So there's a very good chance of that. It always seemed that in terms of operational requirement, the Gripen might have been the solution, and I wouldn't totally count them out. And of course, in terms of interface with existing fleet and experience, you know, Super Hornet. But yeah, your point about Switzerland and France getting together, that would appear to be the case. You know, you look at the recent sale of Rafales to Greece, obviously one big sweetener was some used, I believe 12 used Rafales. I wonder if they couldn't try something like that, you know, say, look, your requirements aren't quite up to Mark IV standard, you know, so why not save some money by buying one squadron new and one squadron used or something like that. And I wouldn't put it past the French Air Force. I think when the French government, I think it's a good idea to use sort of recycle through, if you will, Rafales as a sort of sales tool. You take some of the older ones with some upgrades and use them as a sweetener for sales abroad. But, you know, it's going to be interesting. I don't think it happens till like, what, 2025 or something like that. So it's not exactly a pot of cash coming up anytime soon.
I think it's worth pointing out that these new jets would replace F-18s, which in turn replaced Saab Drakens that were in the Swedish air defense arsenal for many decades. Ron?
Yeah, they also, just to say, they also replace technically F-5s. The Swiss F-5s, have lots of F-5s. They had a high-low mix. So.
And of course, the U.S. Navy got a bunch of those in pristine condition as aggressor traders.
Exactly.
If the Swiss can't look after their aircraft, no one can.
Yes, exactly. Heavily used and yet still minty fresh. Ron, let me bring you into the conversation. Obviously, a little bit of a conversation and some stories on the 500 and discussion on the 500, the notion of a 500 ship Navy. This one, the United States Navy, is around 296 or so ships with a goal of 355 that's being reconsidered in a much, much higher range. Many people in Washington think this is a real pipe dream unless the next administration really puts the screws to the Army, dramatically shrinks the Army, or does a variety of other things because it doesn't work under the same budgetary levels. How did the street take the news? How did you take the news? How likely do you think it is? But, you know, putting the merits of that aside, right? I mean, I think people, there are many who would argue that at a time when the Chinese Navy is growing, it's very important to have a bigger Navy. But then again, you can make the same argument for a bigger Air Force and even a bigger Army, you know, given that at the end of the day, you will have to put soldiers forward. And you know, we may not have enough even to deal with Russia, where we hope the NATO alliance comes together and helps, you know, maintain deterrence there. What was your take?
Yeah, so I think a couple things. You know, I don't think the street fully digested that, you know, that report. I mean, it kind of came out late in the week that Secretary Esper commissioned a couple studies, and those studies suggested a new ship plan that's, you know, what was it, like 408 to 525 ships, a mix of different ships, right? Fewer big ships, fewer aircraft carriers, fewer amphibious assault type ships, and more underwater vehicles, more unmanned things, that sort of stuff. So it's just a different blend of ships. I don't know. I take it with a grain of salt. I don't know how it is for you, but pretty much every Navy person I talk to offline will say, yeah, we're not giving up the carriers. Right. I don't know. Like maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm talking to the wrong people, but I take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. Are we seeing a bigger push back into underseas? Yeah, sure we are, right? I mean, it's been a bull market for submarines and looks like it will be for a while. And, you know, underwater robotics, that sort of stuff, is that an area where there seems to be some pressure and some innovation right now? Yeah, for sure. And probably rightfully so, right? I mean, that underwater domain is a place where the U.S. does seem to have an advantage. Do I think at this moment that the market's pricing in that we're going to have this naval reconnaissance and things, or naval renaissance, and everything's going to change and we're going to have a 500 ship Navy? No, I don't think the street's pricing that in at this point.
Like you just said, remember it was just a year or two ago, of course, that the Air Force came up with its 386 squadrons. It's clearly a pattern of aspirational overreach, perhaps, by the services as they jockey for a better budget position relative to the pivot to Asia. I guess you never get anything if you don't ask. So why not?
Yeah, that's right. If you don't ask, well, the answer is no, isn't it? Any last minute? Sash, bring us home. The Hensoldt and Rolls-Royce equity offerings are underway. Any news on that front before we wrap for the week?
Yeah, Hensoldt, which is the German defense electronics sensors company, their IPO...
Formerly Telefunken.
Telefunken System Technique, and even before that, AEG. So, you know, it's had a number of
even
owners.
Better.
It's now quoted. It priced at the bottom end of the range. The range was 12 to 16 euros, priced at 12 euros, and a bit of a weak opening on Friday. But frankly, the market's been so tough this week, it's probably quite an achievement to get an equity issue away as it is. I think now they're going to have to do quite a lot of investor education on just how that business maintains margins in, you know, mid to high teens when all of their European peers are down at basically just into double digits. You know, it's a very, very profitable business, but it seems to have got there in part through not spending enough on R&D. And I think when you're a sort of $1-3 billion or euro company, you've got to spend a fair amount on R&D to keep up with the Thaleses, which are nearly six times your size. Rolls-Royce is not yet doing an equity offering, but they seem to pretty much every Friday and sometimes over the weekend put out yet another statement saying, we're considering stuff and we haven't ruled anything out and we haven't ruled anything in. I mean, I think this is astonishingly unwise. Traditionally, any public relations advisor would just say, you know, no comment. But Rolls seems to feel it has to comment pretty much every week on the fact that it needs to raise $2-2.5 billion sterling. And its market capitalization is down at, you know, $3 billion sterling. Sovereign wealth funds, Kuwait has been mentioned, Singapore has been mentioned, seem to be being lined up. I can't help feeling that we are getting much closer to a, if not a renationalization by the UK government, at the very least the UK government acting as the backstop for any financing. And hence, you know, Rolls becoming even more state influenced than possibly has been in the last 60, 70 years or so.
I should point out AEG, right? What? Allgemeine Elektrikitats
Gesellschaft,
which I guess was German, which originally was German Edison, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
at some point. I think that wraps it up for the week. And I would commend people to go to Richard Amalafia's website and read his thoughtful monthly newsletter where you talk about NGAD. We covered some of the ground, obviously, on the podcast last week. And I loved, Richard, your, tempered enthusiasm, right? This is great. However, here are a bunch of countervailing things, you know, and I think I share your skepticism. It's one thing to do this and to do it quickly. It's another thing to operationalize the capability and to do it as economically, right? I mean, you make the note that we've done prototypes for this kind of money before as well. The question is, how quickly can you actually start delivering iron on the ramp on a different cost curve, right? I mean, isn't that effectively your argument?
Yeah, that's essentially it in a nutshell. You know, I mean, prototypes are one thing, but this Digital Century series, batches of 75 aircraft that last for 15 years, that is completely unproven. And my not so inner Luddite tells me it's a kind of a pipe dream.
I've never thought of you that way, Richard, for what it's worth. And I've always viewed your opinions as sort of maturing with time, right? I mean, the more you're mulling it, the better they're getting. See, there you go, free advertising. All right, everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Vago.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.